caught between Beijing and freedom today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Hong Kong is supposed to be China's freest city, but even there, speaking to a foreign journalist can mean big trouble.
I participated in this interview, man, it's going to go into the record. Collaboration with a foreign power, okay, that's treason.
Also, waiting in line to get food in Venezuela, no matter what.
I feel like if you're not going to give up your place in line to try to deal with a woman who's collapsed in front of you, how are you going to go out and take to the streets and try to protest and overthrow the government?
Plus, the graffiti conscientious objectors left on the walls of an English castle during World War I.
We have one of the Ten Commandments written on the wall, "Thou shalt not kill."
Those stories coming up today here on The World. We're going to kick things off in Hong Kong today. Hong Kong, semi-autonomous territory, the Chinese mainland, and there is a lot of tension packed into that label, semi-autonomous, because the former British colony is now officially part of China, but its political reality is caught somewhere in between democracy and authoritarianism. That tension was on display today as a top-ranking official from Beijing, Zhang Dejiang, arrived for a, quote, inspection visit in Hong Kong.
Hong Kong is China's freest city, and for the first time, I saw the presence of security authorities prohibiting protesters from actually gathering in the streets.
Nash Jenkins is Time Magazine's correspondent in Hong Kong. He says he's never seen anything like this.
I don't think it's melodramatic to call it a police state. I was not even allowed to enter the designated press zone. I saw student protesters shoved to the ground because they were not in the designated protest zones. The city had employed workers to glue pavement stones to the street to ensure that they wouldn't be thrown as weapons. It was very tense. Clearly, the Hong Kong government wanted to ensure that there was this illusion of peace as Zhang arrived in Hong Kong, but it was really quite shady.
A rapidly materialized police state. It wasn't like that yesterday, I guess. What is the security detail like for Zhang Dejiang? I mean, what is the biggest concern?
One can't help but suspect that the fear of conflict between the authorities and political activists was on the mind of the Hong Kong government as they got ready for this. It was impossible to navigate today. Streets were blocked by police barricades. There are cops stationed on boats in the harbor and on the 45th floor of skyscrapers surveilling the scene. They were really, really meticulously making sure that nothing could have possibly gone wrong. The sense of almost desperate deference to Zhang's presence, which I think is in many ways a metaphor for Hong Kong's relationship with China.
From what you saw, Nash, how angry were demonstrators, even though they couldn't really face the person they wanted to demonstrate in front of? Could they have rioted?
Marco, I think they're frustrated at this point. The protests did not materialize. I would guess, to play armchair psychiatrist, that the protest organizers didn't think the juice was worth the squeeze. That's not to say there isn't potential for major political friction in the streets. It just didn't happen today. But hey, he's in town for two more days, so we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Why is Zhang there? I mean, this inspection visit, what does that mean?
I think it's less about what it means and more about what it symbolizes. You know, on paper, it's a run-of-the-mill routine meeting with Hong Kong leaders, checking in on the city, updating Hong Kong leaders on economic policy. But it's symbolic. The Chinese are crazy about symbolism, and this is the first major Chinese party figure to come to Hong Kong since the pro-democracy protests in 2014. And many people in Hong Kong are buying into the symbolism. They're seeing it as the cruelly watchful eye of mainland China encroaching upon the territory.
Just a quick reality check, Nash. Is it completely off the table that China would ever let Hong Kong go its own way? And if, as I suspect the answer is yes, are Hong Kongers subsequently worried about how far the mainland would go to hang on to Hong Kong?
You know, that's a difficult question, because you have so many various factors to consider here. You know, the fact remains that Hong Kong relies on mainland China for so much of its raw resources. In so many ways, mainland China has the upper hand. Hong Kong wants to be independent, or Hong Kongers want Hong Kong to be independent, because they see their socio-political identity as so fundamentally and existentially distinct from that of mainland China. I think at this point, we're not going to see any acquiescence from the mainland. I think mainland China is going to hold on to Hong Kong for as long as possible.
Nash Jenkins, Time Magazine's man in Hong Kong. Thanks very much, Nash.
Yeah, thank you.
Here's another worrisome development in Hong Kong. Critics of the communist authorities have been getting abducted. This in a city where people are supposed to be able to freely speak their minds. The World's Patrick Nguyen has that story.
That's Gui Minhai, a bookseller from Hong Kong, sobbing on Chinese state TV. He's one of five men from Hong Kong, abducted in recent months, presumably by China. All are linked to a single Hong Kong bookshop. It sells scandalous titles about China's communist leaders, mistresses, corruption, stuff like that. China's Communist Party, they're not big fans. Gui was snatched from a beach town in Thailand. One of his colleagues, Li Bo, a UK citizen, was snatched right off the streets of Hong Kong. He also ended up in mainland China, confessing on TV.
That event is such a game changer. It totally wakes a lot of people up and gets them really, really worried.
That's KC Wong. He's a Hong Kong artist, a provocative one.
This kind of event totally reminds me of those POW in Vietnam War. You know, they forced the soldiers to confess in front of cameras, totally, like, treat them like war criminal.
Like the booksellers, Casey routinely mocks the Communist Party. Could this happen to you? Could you get abducted?
Anybody can. I can. You can.
Casey works in a warehouse overlooking a tropical harbor. His creations include a giant crimson beast with flashing eyes, a red menace terrorizing Hong Kong. He likes to parade it through the streets.
You do seem to enjoy teasing them.
Everybody enjoys teasing them because it's so absurd. It's just unbelievable.
I head downtown to see this scandalous bookshop. I find it near a busy subway station, located under a nail salon.
So I've come to a metal gate, and it looks locked. Okay, shop is shut. And there looks to be sort of a makeshift memorial here. People have just written directly on the wall in ink pen, "Never give up. Freedom is priceless. Big Brother is watching you."
That's how some Hong Kongers talk these days, like they're living in 1984. But the pro-Beijing crowd, they're dramatic too when it comes to Hong Kong.
They can kill the city. The question is, do we let them?
This is a pro-Beijing propaganda video from 2014, spelling out the dangers of the Umbrella Movement, the pro-democracy protest in Hong Kong. Protests haven't killed the city. They haven't liberated the city either. But activists are freaked out by the new wave of abductions.
If we don't want these kind of things to happen again, it is time for all of the people living in Hong Kong to stand up and fight back.
That's Agnes Chow, one of the Umbrella Movement's core leaders. She's only 19. When it comes to resisting Beijing, many Hong Kongers are kind of jaded. But Agnes says students like her are still eager to fight.
Some people may think that because we are young, we may have no power in fighting against the regime. But I think it's a responsibility for young people to advocate the power of people in one city.
You've seen people that have been abducted, they end up on Chinese state TV, crying and apologizing. If you were forced into that type of situation, how do you think that you would hold up?
I don't know. In that situation, if I don't do things according to their orders, I'll die, I don't know. But I'll try my best to fight against all the things because I don't want these kind of things to happen again in the future.
Agnes and other student activists just started a new political party. It's called Demosisto. Its first poster features Agnes, with a bow and arrow, posing like Katniss Everdeen, the Hunger Games heroine who overthrows an authoritarian state. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Hong Kong.
You remember the graffiti scene in Catcher in the Rye? Holden Caulfield sees F.U. scrawled on a wall, and that's where he draws the line. Everything has been corrupted by vulgarity. But at Richmond Castle in England, graffiti is not vulgar, it's historic. The castle's been standing for almost 1,000 years, built not long after William the Conqueror took over, in 1066, in fact. Over the years, Richmond Castle has been used as a prison. Prisoners during World War I left some interesting graffiti on the walls. Megan Leyland is from English Heritage, the organization that's now going to work to preserve that graffiti. It's amazing, Megan, that people in England were still being locked up in medieval castles less than 100 years ago. Why were these World War I prisoners there?
These prisoners were conscientious objectors to the First World War, which meant they refused to fight on the grounds of, say, religion or politics. And Richmond Castle in 1916 became a base for the non-combatant corps. Now, this was a unit where men could support the war effort, but without fighting or without using arms. For some, however, their fundamental beliefs meant that even this they couldn't do, they couldn't accept. Mm. And it was when those men refused orders at Richmond Castle that they were placed in the 19th century block there, which was adapted for use as a cell block.
What does this block look like?
It's a basic square block. There are 8 cells across 2 floors. They're pretty cramped. I can just put my arms from one end to the other and someone could probably lie down. But it's dark, it's damp, and it's ever so cold.
Yeah, so like stone, brick, kind of a classic dungeon.
Yeah, quite like that.
So they left behind this amazing graffiti on the walls of the castle. What's so amazing about it? What is it? Are they pictures? Are they words?
There's a real variety of things, sort of etched, scratched, drawn with blunt pencils onto the wall, from beautiful, delicate portraits of a fiancé, one of the conscientious objectors' mothers, to political slogans and religious sentiment. We have hymns, we have biblical verse. So a real variety of different things that these men wanted to leave on the walls when they left their mark.
And kind of all spinning off their conscientious objector status and pacifism, is that the idea?
Yeah, quite a lot of it. So we have one of the Ten Commandments written on the wall, "Thou shalt not kill." Another man wrote, "The only war which is worth fighting is the class war." So a bit of socialist sentiment there. And it gives you a real insight into some of the reasons why men objected to the war.
These inmates, these COs, I mean, they got a name. They got a reputation. The Richmond 16, they became known as.
Yeah, so on the 29th of May 1916, they were taken from Richmond Castle and shipped over to France. And now when you're in France, in the theatre of war, and you disobey orders, you could potentially face the being shot, the death sentence. And these men continued in their resistance to war, continued to refuse to fight, were court-martialed and sentenced to death. And in a dramatic scene, this was reduced to 10 years hard labour. But they were willing to go all the way, face the ultimate deterrent. They would rather be killed than kill.
So how are you going to go about preserving this graffiti and also at the same time kind of showcasing what these men stood for?
The graffiti itself is on very thin lime wash, delicate surface. We have damp coming in and this causes a flaking. So the flakes come off. So what we're going to try and do is bring the environment to a safe level, so to remove some of that moisture to prevent the deterioration of this graffiti further. And in the meantime, we're putting up loads of online resources and images so that people can come and have a look themselves and discover these different stories and all these different voices which come from the writings on the wall.
Megan Leyland with English Heritage, the organization that's now going to preserve graffiti on the walls of Richmond Castle. Megan, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Later on the show, a green card for $500,000. Yeah, you get a soccer stadium with it too, on the world. We've got a story now about a couple here in Boston. He's from the Democratic Republic of Congo. She's from Nigeria. They're African immigrants. And as we'll hear from reporter Heidi Shin, they're on a mission to get people here to eat African and healthier.
Well, we're talking about fufu. It's like a Congolese dish made from mashed potatoes and corns. You know, you can heat it with your hands.
That's Leonard Chitenge, talking about the food he loved as a kid, growing up in Congo. Now he lives in Brockton, Massachusetts, where his 2 kids are all about chicken nuggets and fries, especially his son.
He's a picky eater, so his thing is always chicken nuggets and fries.
So Leonard got an idea. He and his wife Felicia, who's from Nigeria, they volunteered to teach African-American communities here, and anyone else who might be curious, how to eat like they did back home in Africa.
Yeah, our soup is ready.
We're at the Boston Public Market, an upscale venue for local farmers and food entrepreneurs. And it feels a lot like a family has crowded a kitchen at home to cook a holiday meal. Men and women are poring over cookbooks, squeezing by each other, pots and pans, and Felicia oversees a sweet potato peanut stew bubbling on the stove from Senegal.
For that, the ingredients are diced tomatoes, peanut butter, carrots, zucchini. So we're going to get started. So I'm going to heat up the oil.
Brandon Ransom brought his 10-month-old, eager to introduce the little guy to okra. He's an African-American nutritionist who's tired of hearing about the benefits of a Mediterranean diet. We don't all need to eat like the Greeks to eat healthy, he says.
There are alternative foods that other cultures have historically eaten that can be slightly shifted and slightly changed for a whole different perspective of what is healthy and what is nutritious.
Like collard greens, for example. Leave out the ham hocks. Or make yuca fries instead of French fries. And the class is introduced to a different kind of food pyramid, one that's filled with foods native to Africa, like mustard greens, tubers, and peanuts. And there's just a tiny slice of sweet potato pie at the very top, in the sometimes only category.
Don't be shy. Help yourselves, okay?
But for all this talk of getting back to roots, class instructor Chioma Woko notes this. Her family in Nigeria, they're starting to eat a lot more like Americans, too.
They definitely are eating more processed food because of globalization. And there's a lot of fast food in Nigeria, but it is still a thing of relative wealth. Like, not everyone has access to that type of food because it costs money to eat that way.
But the opposite is true in America. And those who come to the class, the academics, the activists, and the other leaders in the African-American community here, they say that learning a few new recipes, this isn't enough. In some neighborhoods, they say, there aren't even supermarkets. And fresh produce, it should cost less than fast food. So they brainstorm ideas for where to bring the class next, to places like community centers and churches in their neighborhoods.
You guys are awesome.
But even Leonard admits it's hard. Even he's prone to picking up a $4 meal at Wendy's every now and then.
So I don't want to make it like I'm presenting like, hey, I'm perfect and we got this. No, I think that it's a struggle. We are struggling in this together and motivating each other.
The final course is a mango and papaya fruit salad, a West African dessert with bits of coconut, peanuts, and honey. Tess Brown, who's 70, says it brings back memories of growing up in Trinidad and Tobago.
I mean, all of this food is so much like things I grew up with. You know, the root vegetables and the rice and, but even today's dessert.
These days, she confesses, she eats mostly takeout and some microwave stuff. But the class has inspired her to change her ways.
I know, I got good genes from my mom. She passed at 93 and she had great, and she had more discipline than I do, though, for how she ate and so I've tried to do that.
For the World, Heidi Shin, Boston.
I want to follow up now on an interview you heard on the show this past Friday. My guest was Saba Ahmed. She's a Pakistani-American lawyer and the founder of the Republican Muslim Coalition. And this year, she says she's voting for Donald Trump.
I'll be supporting the GOP nominee at the Republican Muslim Coalition. We hope to see a GOP candidate win the White House. If Donald Trump ends up being the nominee, then yes, we will be supporting him.
After that interview, we asked you to go to our Facebook page for a discussion with Saba about the role of Muslim Americans within the Republican Party today and the idea that the party could be influenced from the inside. We heard from a lot of you. Karen Peterson is the World's social media editor. Hey, Karen.
Hi, Marco.
So what was the general tone of some of the responses you've been reading?
It was split. I mean, you have a lot of people who are definitely criticizing Saba for signing up with a party who seems to be pretty anti-Muslim, despite the fact that they also line up with a lot of Muslim economic and moral values. Because at least, like, you know, at the end of the day, if you want to sign up with Democrats, they're not telling people that they're going to bar Muslims from the country, period.
Right. Even Saba herself said there seems to be a tolerance that in the Democratic Party that attracts a lot of Muslims.
Yeah, exactly. I want to read one comment specifically, actually, from one of our listeners. His name is Yosef Ulemi. His comment was, of course, having people work within the system empowers those people to impact the party, but at first we have to be accepted.
Right. Acceptance first. What about the people who agreed with Saba?
Oh, there was a ton of those, too. Mm. There was a lot of really supportive comments who came in for the work that she's doing. They said that, I mean, the GOP could definitely use with an influx of diverse voices. There's this one commenter, her name's Anna Harreveld, and she said, "I subscribe to the trickle-up effect. If communities can become passionate and devoted to laws that affect them and then subscribe that passion to promoting and electing individuals from their communities to local, state, senate, and then national offices, then there will be change." So there was a lot of other people who, though, said, "Yeah, you can join the party, but you shouldn't be supporting Trump."
Yeah, I'll bet the whole issue of Trump on the internet got a little heated.
Yeah, typical. One of the things that people are saying is that parties really aren't forever. So while Saba is joining up with a party that exists, a lot of people are saying that parties have come and gone and maybe it's time for the GOP to disappear. There's one person who said, "The GOP is no fact of nature whose existence is guaranteed." So that kind of speaks to the point that people were making about parties not being forever.
Yeah, I mean, I'm no U.S. history expert, but I do know political parties over the years morph and split. Let's not forget the Federalists and the Whigs. And when the nation was founded, there was the Republican Democratic Party. So
yeah, exactly. So one of the things that I do want to do is this is just one of those Facebook chats. We actually have Facebook chats with smart, intelligent sources about topics that really matter. We do it relatively often. So if you want to come and hang out with me on Facebook, you can just look us up. We're Peer Eyes the World on Facebook.
All right. Kieran Peterson, the world's social media editor. Thank you for all that.
Thanks, Marco.
We've got just a minute or so before the news break, enough time to share a track from a CD we got over a month ago. And I've been waiting to play for you. It's a new one from Bombino, the virtuoso guitarist from Niger in West Africa, a country that sits in the middle of the Sahara Desert. Bombino's new album is called Azel. Here's one song from it in the Tuareg language. Translation, "A Great Desert I Saw." Music there from Bombino. News is next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Jenny Lyric and Jenna Rose are the LA musical duo Coco Avenue. They're known for covers of Korean pop songs.
We're just kind of producing music, and whatever we're classified as, that's what it is. You know?
But it's not so much what we classify ourselves as.
Yeah,
so.
We just like to sing in Korean.
Coco Avenue plays Seoul, Korea. That's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Venezuela used to be one of the richest and safest countries in Latin America, thanks in part to abundant oil. But then falling oil prices plunged much of the country into poverty. With the crisis worsening, most Venezuelans want President Nicolas Maduro to step down. But now the president has declared a state of emergency, which actually expands his power while the country tries to cope. Hannah Dreyer reports for the Associated Press from the Venezuelan capital of Caracas. When you walk around Caracas today, Hannah, what are the signs that this is a really dire moment for the country?
Yeah, Caracas has started to really feel like a ghost town. This is the country with the world's cheapest oil, but there aren't as many cars on the streets these days, because when something breaks in your car, it's basically a dead car. There's no imports coming in to fix it. We have these food lines that are expanding. And lately, you see a lot of kids in those lines because a lot of schools have shut down, either wow. because there's no water coming in or teachers aren't showing up. You've started to see people eating the mangoes off the trees here, which are usually just kind of for decoration.
Wow. The mango factor. So I've also been hearing about a spike in looting and violence there. How bad is it and what's behind it?
That's right. These days in Caracas, when you see a knot of people, there's a chance that it might be a person on the ground who is accused of being a thief and is getting beat up. used to be that when you saw a group of people, you could assume that products had come into a store. It's just the impunity here is getting to people. People walk around and the city is a cauldron of stress and fear. And in some cases, these guys are getting killed.
I mean, it's kind of understandable then that the president would invoke the state of emergency, but it also kind of allows President Maduro to expand his powers. How are people responding to that move?
Yeah, you'd think people would be freaking out. Imagine if Obama decided over the weekend he didn't want to work with the opposition Congress anymore, and he was just going to give himself decree powers for 60 days. Everybody who doesn't like Obama would be pretty angry. And here, people really don't like Maduro. But people are just overwhelmed with getting through daily life here. I've heard people complaining lately that the opposition talks too much about human rights and about the Constitution, when what they're really dealing with is just trying to put food on the table and get water to, you know, flush their toilets.
What do you think President Maduro is playing at by declaring the state of emergency?
Well, it's clear that people want him to do something. People want him out, but that doesn't seem especially likely to happen. And in the meantime, there's not a lot he can really do to improve the situation here. Maduro likes to say that the right wing is waging an economic war. So this could be seen as another way to stop that economic war. Like, he's taking control and he's really going to fight the businessmen this time.
Is there anything to that? Is the right wing fighting an economic war?
I mean, the right wing would definitely like to see Maduro out of office, just like the majority of voters. But it seems pretty clear that it's a larger issue than just his political opponents.
I've been hearing rumblings, too, of a military coup. Is that possible, and who would the actors be? Like, army on Maduro's side to calm public anger, or army that would remove Maduro?
Yeah, the military has traditionally been the arbiter of these political fights in Venezuela. The military is also generally very well taken care of. So the military has access to cars, which the rest of the country doesn't. When food imports come in, the military will get those first.
Sounds like what you're saying is the army's still on Maduro's side.
Well, they haven't staged a coup yet. What's more likely is that there'll be kind of an internal political coup within the Socialist Party, that the socialists know that Maduro is kind of a hopeless case at this point, and so they might try to put somebody else in the presidency next year.
So with this crisis, Hannah, is this kind of looking like the end of the Chavista revolution?
I mean, it would be the end of the revolution if people would take to the streets, but it's just not clear that that's going to happen. I was reporting in a food line earlier this month, and a 7-year-old woman collapsed in my arms, and I was with her on the ground asking, what should we do? Should we call an ambulance? And nobody even got out of line. So I ended up taking her in a cab to the emergency room. It turned out she hadn't eaten all day. And I feel like if you're not going to give up your place in line to try to deal with a woman who's collapsed in front of you, how are you going to go out and take to the streets and try to protest and overthrow the government?
Is that a typical reaction from Venezuelans when something happens like that on the sidewalk in a public place?
I don't think you would have seen this even just a few years ago. This used to be the richest country in the region. It used to be really a lot like the States in some ways. But there's just been this breakdown in society. People are desperate.
Hannah Dreyer reports from Caracas for the Associated Press. Great to speak with you again, Hannah. Thank you.
Good talking with you.
Our next story deals with a very different problem from what they're dealing with in Venezuela. We're shifting over to Florida and to the question of how to pay for a new sports stadium there. You know how it usually goes. A team owner sweet-talks the public into putting up millions of dollars for the arena. In return, we get to watch our favorite athletes do their thing for a hefty price. But people and city councils are souring on the idea of publicly financed stadiums. Enter the owner of Orlando City, one of the newest teams to join MLS, Major League Soccer. He came up with a clever way to raise cash, foreign investment. It involves a little-known program called the EB-5. Foreign investors pony up $500,000 each, and in return they get a share of their investment, in this case a soccer stadium, and a green card. It's one of the first times the EB-5 program has been used to finance sports. That's a word from Ken Belson. He's reported on the Orlando City Stadium Project for the New York Times.
What happened in their case is they had originally reached out to the city, county, and state to get some help building their stadium, a not uncommon formula, and the city and county came up with their share, but the state refused to agree to a sales tax rebate. And the clock was ticking. They had to open their new stadium by the beginning of 2017. So they were in a bit of a bind, and they struck on this idea as the best way to get some financing.
And this whole approach, it's legal? I mean, this is like if you're rich enough, you can buy a green card. It doesn't really seem fair.
It's interesting. That's a common refrain, is we're allowing people to cut in line because they happen to have money, and that seems very undemocratic. In fact, many countries have these programs or versions of these programs. America's not new in this. And this program's been around for 25 years. It's not new itself. And probably not surprisingly, the vast majority of people who have applied have come from China. Obviously, many of them clamoring to come here to the United States. And also, they have an explosive amount of wealth. And putting it in dollars is a pretty good hedge against turmoil, economic or political, in their home countries.
I mean, here in Boston, I know there's a lot of real estate being snatched up by Saudi and Chinese investors and businesses. Perhaps they have some green card benefit as well. But there's also this trend for many years now of stadium corporate sponsorship like TD Garden and the Kodak Theater in Los Angeles. Was it really that hard finding investors to build the stadium in Orlando?
Well, I think the preference of any owner is not to use his own money if he can help it. If you can get the city or state to build it for you and then lease it from them, it's a lot less risk for the owner. There's, of course, many people who say, look, you're making money off the building. Why don't you just pay for it yourself? And in this case, it's essentially 100% private. So I guess in many ways, the local politicians are very happy about this because it's less of a burden on their local taxpayers.
And you think this is a stadium financing model for the near and distant future, along with that green card benefit?
That's actually something that quite a few teams have already tried and haven't been able to make it work. Part of the problem is the way that this financing comes in. So if you go to the bank window and say, all right, I'll take out a 10-year loan or a 20-year loan, the money's just transferred once you're approved and you get a lump sum. When you go through this green card process, it comes in drips and drabs. You might get 10 applications, but even those applications have to get approved by the FBI to make sure the money isn't being laundered. Then money has to be transferred. Money's put into escrow. Everybody has to, there's a lot of paperwork involved. So it's hard to finance everything accurately and timely when you have a stadium that has to open on a very fixed date. And so that's really been the kind of conundrum that a lot of teams have come up against, is they like the idea of it, but in fact, getting all the money at once is not easy. So in this case, they've put up a lot of the money to start the project. To get it off the ground, the girders are already up, the skeleton of the stadium's largely complete. But then they'll use the money from the Visa candidates to sort of backfill the financing.
Ken Belson with the New York Times, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks, Marco.
For the past 5 years, Libya has been a country in chaos. First, there was the revolution that toppled dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, then a free-for-all civil war as rival factions battled for control of the country. More recently, extremist groups like ISIS have moved in, and a United Nations-backed unity government has been formed to try and bring some much-needed stability. Not exactly the ideal place to be doing business, but Alaeddine Muntasser is trying. He's a businessman based in Tripoli, used to be involved in the energy industry, but with the collapse of oil prices, he switched to construction. He says one of his projects right now involves restoring Tripoli's Corniche, a waterfront promenade that had started to crumble and fall into the Mediterranean.
Anything is better than oil. Construction is still pretty bad, but at least there are a few projects here and there.
The Corniche, of course, is that beautiful road that runs along the Mediterranean in Tripoli. Really evocative. Building and getting investors, though. You need money. So banking in Libya in 2016. Describe for us what a regular trip to the bank in Tripoli is like these days. How does it work?
It's extremely chaotic. It's actually a very sad sight. I drive by every day on the way to the office, and it's like people waiting for handouts. It's not like customers were coming to withdraw money from their banks. The normal person waiting for his salary or his social security or whatever has to stand in line for days sometimes to get something as little as $10.
Do you trust the people who work at the bank? Is that part of the problem?
No, not really. First of all, we've had bank accounts where we found there was less money than there should be. A lot of times they don't have the money to give you. So I know people have millions in the bank and they can't withdraw anything. a lot of the information that goes to kidnappers is from the banks about who has what.
Wow.
To use the bank is useless.
I mean, we know the security situation is very hard in Libya, but the idea that banks are filling in thieves and militias with information about money, that's a little scary.
Oh, of course. We are very paranoid now. We don't trust anybody. We don't trust the police.
Western powers, as you know, announced yesterday that they are ready to arm Libya's struggling unity government. Do you think that's a wise move?
Oh, but who is the unity government's army? Who's getting the weapons? That's what concerns me. They have to arm somebody to fight ISIS, but not everybody is fighting ISIS. There's no national army. Gaddafi worked years to destroy the national army, to have his own militias take over. He was scared of a national army, so he destroyed it.
In Libya right now, are there good militias and bad militias?
Of course. There are good ones and there are bad ones. There are ones created to fight and destroy a tyrannical regime in Libya, and they continue to do so for the country. And there are ones that were created to make money, to gain control, or to be pawns in the hands of some political party or other. There are many that we thought were good, and they simply became just a gang.
We first spoke with you after the killing of the U.S. ambassador to Libya, Chris Stevens, in 2012, a man who you counted among your friends. You told us then that Chris really seemed to believe in Libya. I'm just wondering, do you still believe in Libya?
I absolutely do. What we accomplished in 2011 shows me that Libya can, and Libyan people can do a lot of good things, and we can still do it. And what we're facing right now might be a little bigger than what I expected to face, but we will overcome it too.
So it'd be hard to know what is the unity government currently in Libya, but generally speaking, do you think the idea of the West helping out the government, whatever that is a good thing?
Yes, this government needs help. We've tried for 5 years now to do our own thing and we failed. And maybe this is the solution. I'm willing to accept it and try it. But the help from the West needs to be something that's studied very carefully to make sure that if it's weapons or money, it goes to the right places. The corruption in Libya right now, I actually admit it's worse than it was during the Gaddafi regime, which was one of the worst and most corrupt regimes in history of Libya. The budget for Libya, since Gaddafi died until now, they spent about $150 billion. It comes
billion
to about $150 billion. Correct. The only thing new that we see around Tripoli, and this is a joke, but it's real, are speed bumps. So where did this $150 billion, with a B, dollars go? This is the level of corruption we have. Gaddafi did do the same thing over 40 years, but I don't think he stole $150 billion in 5 years.
Businessman Alaeddine Muntasser speaking with me from Tripoli. Great to have you on the show again.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. I'm no expert in pop music from Korea, better known as K-pop. Okay, I know Psy and his massive global hit Gangnam Style. And with that in mind, I'd say this song definitely qualifies as K-pop.
I am a good girl. 어지간히 들었어 남자들은 난 보면 내 부러켜.
Could be one of many girl groups from Korea, probably, but no, this is Coco Avenue, a duo based in Los Angeles, and they're not Korean, not even Korean-American, they're African-American. Jenny Lyric is originally from St. Louis, Jenna Rose was born in New Brunswick, New Jersey. More on how they found each other in a moment. We found them on their first trip to South Korea in Seoul, where they're playing their version of K-pop in the land where it all started.
Initially snuck up on us. Neither one of us were really familiar with it at all.
Is this Jenny or Jenna speaking here?
This is Jenna. I was watching a TV show in America called So You Think You Can Dance.
Mm-hmm.
And the Wonder Girls performed. They were one of the biggest girl groups at that time from Korea. Seeing their video on YouTube was kind of the gateway to seeing every other like K-pop act after that. And this was back in 2010.
2009.
No, oh, it was 2009. But the way we discovered each other is that after discovering K-pop, I decided to make YouTube videos. She was doing the same thing already. So people would message Jenny thinking that I was her. They would be like, oh, Jenny, or what would they say?
They would say like, oh, Jenna Rose, you're so awesome. And I'm like, I'm Jenny, but thank you. So eventually I messaged Jenna and I was like, hey, so I think we're kind of like twins. Let's do some covers together. And then that's kind of how we got started, like, in our friendship.
Mm-hmm. What a fantastic story. So you were early adopters even before Psy and Gangnam Style. So you've kind of made it because you're in South Korea doing your first tour there. What's that tour been like?
Well, it's not exactly a tour. We booked a show at a club. And it was just one show, but it was amazing. The crowd was amazing. We had supporters come. People were singing the songs along with us.
It was a big deal because we were not sure what sort of reception we would get being in Korea. In America, this sort of thing is not necessarily new. People do covers all the time. We perform all the time in LA. So our faces are known. But we did not know that we would be known here. So when we got to the venue and these people are waiting on us and they're wanting to take pictures and they're standing in the front of the stage, you know, shouting out the same words we're singing, that was surreal and really appreciated.
It's so cool because, I mean, these are songs that they know already, but now they've got these two women who are doing them again. And when you talk to people after the show, did you ask them why they came and what they were into about your version of this music?
When we sing covers, it's not necessarily our goal to recreate the same feeling that the original artists have. It's our goal to put our own thing, our own sound, into what they've already created. And I think the people who watch our covers appreciate that we take that twist on it. It was cool to be able to sing covers at the performance, but we did also get to sing our originals.
Are those original songs in English or in Korean?
It's in English.
Yeah, this
right
one was
now,
in English.
But we will have Korean versions of all of our original songs.
Mm-hmm.
So you do this cover of a song called You Know by a Korean star named Jay Park. I hear in there a hook that goes, me and hey, and I have no idea what that means. Maybe you do. When you sing Korean lyrics, do you go just for the phonetic accuracy or do you understand Korean and can really pick up the emotion in the song?
We understand a lot of Korean. That particular line, "미안해" means I'm sorry.
Mm.
It's important for us to learn as much as possible and look up the lyrics, make sure that we're portraying it in the best way possible.
Are any critics in Korea kind of challenging you on the purism of K-pop? Like, what you're doing isn't really K-pop.
We've had a couple of critics, but not in
Korea. Yeah.
We've had Korean-Americans or Asian-Americans criticize us or saying that because we aren't contributing to the Korean, money
because
to Korea.
Because the money we earn doesn't go to Korea.
Yeah,
we're
so
not
then it
K-pop
makes us not K-pop.
But we're the label that is being thrown at us a lot is, you know, the first African-American K-pop stars. And we're just kind of producing music. And whatever we're classified as is that's what it is. Mm-hmm. You know?
But it's not so much what we classify ourselves as.
Yeah,
so
we just like to sing in Korean.
You must know by now, you've seen it, South Korea is pretty homogenous, and there are negative stereotypes of blacks as, you know, being aggressive or poor or both. Have you faced challenges to what you're doing with this very popular pop music there?
As far as the music, not so much. Our main goal in doing this really is to educate, because the thing about K-pop right now, especially what's popular right now, is that a lot of it is drawn from the African-American culture. Not even just African-American. There's a lot of things
Hispanic
that are drawn
culture.
From Hispanic culture, Native American culture. And so we think that having more cultures represented in this industry is important in order for us to be able to understand how to share cultures without being insensitive. Being out here, Jenny and I really have realized that it is super homogenous. There's a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of misconceptions when it comes to ethnicity and race. And I think what we do, we're not naive enough to think that we can change everything, but we do want to be a part of the conversation when it comes to things like this.
Yeah, so do you think with this trip and your music, you're succeeding in breaking through those stereotypes? And are you making that musical Korean African American connection kind of boomeranging back to where it came from?
I believe so. I believe that we've opened, even the different articles and things that have come out, we've opened a lot of doors for conversations to be started about what is K-pop and how is it drawing from, you know, other places and how can they do that more responsibly.
So I got to ask you this. I don't know if you know, but South Korea has been using K-pop as propaganda music, blasting it across the DMZ to North Korea. How would you feel if they pulled out a Coco Avenue track and blasted that to the North Koreans?
We would love it. That would actually be awesome. Yeah, the whole tension between North Korea and South Korea.
I'd rather not get involved.
We'd rather
in that.
Stay out.
So if they could just not play our music, that would be cool.
Okay. So you started, yeah, that'd be cool, but maybe on second thought, not
yeah,
such a great
idea.
Yeah,
actually, no, now that I'm thinking about it, yeah,
probably. Jenny Lyric and Jenna Rose are Coco Avenue. They've been speaking with me from Seoul, South Korea. Thanks very much. Best of luck to you guys.
Thank you so much.
Music from Coco Avenue. I'm going to go ahead and call them a K-pop duo based in Los Angeles. They get to drop the mic today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.